Self-aware versus self-conscious. Whether you view Eden as an instructive myth or as literal truth, indulge me a bit here. In the Eden story, the man and his woman were completely naked and weren't able to even be aware of this. They were completely unself-conscious, lacked the capacity to even know. By contrast, if I was walking around in a garden with my junk hanging out, I would have trouble losing sight of this reality. I'm observant like that. But the happy couple in the story went ahead and tried to better themselves without God's hand being part of it. No doubt he intended a slower entry into self-awareness than the short, sharp shock that the trespass and following the advice of the serpent brought them. But they went that way, and everything changed. Now they knew good and evil. It wasn't just that they had a conscience that knew right from wrong. It was better and worse than that. They didn't just know that they'd done something wrong. It wasn't just about their actions being wrong, but also about knowing that part of who they were was not good, was evil, twisted, dark, tempted towards theft, murder, and rape. Look at what they'd already managed to do, ruin humanity. Reinhold Niebuhr said, "The tragedy of man is that he can conceive self-perfection, but cannot achieve it." Knowing you're not good doesn't mean you can just turn good. You're stuck. All resolutions and vows to the contrary. Knowledge does not equal maturity. With this new knowledge, the man and woman gained a huge problem. Because now they knew any number of things they just weren't ready for. They knew good, and they knew evil. They knew that God was good, and the serpent was evil, and they knew which side they'd taken. They knew it was very much too late to take it back. Even if you know how to act well, to do the right thing, this isn't the same as being able to consistently be a good person. So the primordial couple wanted to hide and blame each other, which isn't good, and they knew that too. Their firstborn son would go on to murder his brother due to those same feelings of not being good enough. Rejection and lifelong feelings of inadequacy became universal human experiences right at the beginning. This was probably not what God had wanted, but it was also not beyond his ability to sort out. But when God came to talk to the primordial couple, instead of just going and talking to him like before, they now realized that he was good and they weren't. And they felt as naked as they were, exposed. They wanted to be worthy. They didn't want to be naked. They wanted to hide their vulnerability and ultimately themselves. They feared rejection, and it was coming. From their own newly cognizant selves first, from their spouse next, and finally, from God himself. Every single personality, cognitive, emotional, spiritual, and physical lack they possessed, every flaw they developed, would now be something they'd know and keenly feel. No more innocence or ignorance. And they'd keenly feel their Maker and the only other human being on earth knowing their flaws too. Their standard for good was God created, and was up to his own standard. The serpent hadn't created the fruit. Evil does not create, because the act of creation has good all over it, and it worked perfectly, even though they weren't supposed to have it. Perhaps he would have given it to them eventually, when he deemed it a good time. The fact that it existed at all suggests he might have had plans, so it's up to us to decide, one supposes, whether his plans involve future blessing or proving present guilt through manipulation. Was the tree a trick or a future gift? It's been said that hell is other people. I think that these two proto-people, having taken paradise for granted as normal, as it was normal for them to do, then experienced a kind of hell. For them, hell was knowing what good and evil were and seeing with terrible clarity their own position teetering between the two, with no ability to attain good on their own, and the very real risk of falling utterly to evil just by continuing to live the way they'd been headed. Hell was knowing themselves. Hell was should. Hell was not being able to keep their best vows. Their hell was being self-conscious, the thing God hadn't wanted for them, at least at that point in time, a thing God gave no other animal either, a thing animals do not have to this day, which is why chimpanzees don't feel naked, and why cats do not feel like failures as cats, no matter how fat they may grow and how inept they may be at hunting down small animals. This is why horses don't wear shorts. God had made a paradise for human beings. Paradise wasn't about being perfect, spiritual, enlightened, deep beings who were masters of empathy. It was about not worrying about the fact that you weren't, because you didn't even know you weren't. It wasn't about always remembering that self was your worst enemy and vowing to deny self and punish self and control self. It was, as is the case for babes in the womb, being utterly unself-conscious. Innocent. And you can't very easily have innocence and knowledge. In the New Testament, there is occasional reference made to self-judgment or self-examination, but there is no encouragement or commandment given to Christians for self-doubt and self-loathing. Because self-doubt and self-loathing aren't good. They're an evil. We know that. And we have that capacity now, thanks to Adam. And they make us weak and indecisive and self-focused. They are, in fact, hellish, misery that does not make us any better or tell us anything new or useful. And shame does not push us to approach God. It tempts us to try lame, fleshly, superficial lifestyle fix-ups instead, and to flee from Him and the truth entirely. Self-conscious teen years. I remember being an older teen and younger adult and feeling painfully aware of my own imperfection, my own stupidity, weakness, frailty, folly, and general lack of deserving acceptance, love, or anything nice ever. Now, where did that come from? Adam in the garden? My family? My church? Society? The media? I'm thinking maybe it came from all of the above. From people. Not from God. Because this suffering and the knowledge that I wasn't as good as I could have been wasn't doing any good. Of course, if you had told me this back then, I would have just added this to the list of things about me that weren't good. I still hadn't grasped the idea that worrying is trying to change the course of events and one's own essential nature and any number of immutable things using only one's own willpower and attentiveness. I still hadn't decided to try to bring an end to the worrying through Jesus, to be careful for nothing. I'm not very good at it yet. And I wasn't a pretty young woman, so I didn't get the compliments that people from that delightful subsection of humanity often get and miss keenly when they're older. Even so, sometimes people got sick of how much self-loathing and doubt they saw in me, and they tried giving me measured, strongly worded doses of compliments or reality. They would list my strengths or accomplishments for me. One kind lady actually wrote me a list on paper at work, and it rolled right off me like water off a duck's back. It just didn't work, not even a bit. There was a hole in the bottom of my capacity to accept myself and my journey and where I was at. So even my father was never going to convince me that I wasn't a big disappointment and just plain weird and quite beyond regular folks' ability to predict or understand the motives of. Ditto my mother. Same thing my church. Also my coworkers. As well, what peers I had. None of them were going to make me stop loathing myself. None of them would ever convince me of the importance of extending to myself the same level of tolerance and kindness one might be expected to show a homeless person on the street. Of course, most of them weren't trying to convince me of this in the first place. Most of them were telling me that self was my enemy, to crucify myself daily and keep it in the place of death. I was my own taskmaster and judge, and my standards were higher than God's. I had none of His grace or mercy. I was never going to let myself off the hook for being who I was. If every single one of these other core entities in my life had told me in no uncertain terms that they accepted me unreservedly, deeply appreciated a number of my abilities and interests, and that they predicted great things for me and wouldn't change a thing about me, it is only vaguely possible that I might have been moved to perhaps contemplate believing them slightly. But probably, I would have, in this very imaginary scenario, have done the far easier thing. The thing that wouldn't have required any personal growth. I would have decided that they didn't know, and they were all wrong, and would certainly cast me out into the streets if they knew me the way I did. I'd arrogantly decide I was the only one who was right about my wrongness. So what cured me of self-loathing and crippling, hellish self-consciousness? What made me self-confident? That didn't exactly ever happen 100%, I guess, but here's what did. I got skinny from not eating, and my sister continued to call me fat. I got friends, and my father and sister, neither of whom had many lasting friendships, continued to tell me the reason I had no friends was because I had such a problematic personality and no social skills. I got a university degree without really going to class much, and my sister still called me stupid. I started drinking alcohol in moderation, never indulging in excess, and the meeting started to treat me like the town drunk. I was kind to teenage boys who wanted to talk about playing guitar or who had problems at home, and people from my church told others that I was a gay person or a pedophile. I was a sounding board or confidant to any number of troubled young women and wives, and people spread false rumors about me taking advantage of them and breaking up their marriages, which I never did, though no doubt I could have. I decided to follow God instead of just being religious, and my meeting forbade young people talking to me, used a pretense to excommunicate me to perpetuity, called me a wicked person, affixed Bible verses to me lumping me in with adulterers, rapists, thieves, and drunkards, and banned me from all church activities. Many devout brethren people refused even to eat in any room I was eating in, no matter if the event was a wedding, a funeral, or job-related, lest they get any of me on them and their position, status, or image. And it certainly wasn't just me who got this kind of over-the-top treatment. My culture did that kind of stuff to literally hundreds of people, many of whom have gone on to be valued members of their own new churches elsewhere, many of whom I really like and see value in. So I didn't learn that I was okay, exactly. I learned that other people didn't know a thing about me or who God wanted and had designed me to be. I learned that they'd say pretty much anything about anyone. And the people who got the most respect in my meeting culture were hardly even convincing as human beings, let alone people who had something of Christ to share. It's almost like the official damning of me and pretty much everyone I knew kind of made it impossible eventually to take these kind of judgments terribly seriously. They were too reflexive, frightened, and way too over the top. It got so I couldn't take any of that at face value. It started to become funny. I'd like to say that now, when someone says something judgmental, unfair, or untrue about me, I don't feel it much. I can't really say that, but I think it's safe to say that I've learned the difference between being utterly paralyzed, endlessly tortured by self-doubt and self-loathing, and doing stuff. So now people say stuff. There are always people who say stuff, but usually I keep right on doing stuff anyway. I think it's good. And I noticed something weird too. I took inventory of the huge number of accusations I'd collected to clutch warmly to my bosom on cold winter nights for the rest of my days, and I noticed that almost every time anyone ever accused me of anything at all, ever, it was generally for one of two reasons. Didn't matter whether I was guilty or not, there were still two reasons which tended to prompt people to accuse me of a given thing. It was either they were accusing me of something they were afraid they themselves were guilty of, or they were accusing me of something of which they themselves clearly were, apparently the only person left on earth still unaware of the fact that they were very, very guilty. I think that's why most people even have an interest in making all of these pointed judgments of their fellow men to begin with. There is a personal connection to the judgments, an echo coming back at them. I only get told I talk too much by people who want to talk too much themselves. I'm taking their airtime. It works for all of my other vices as well. Pots call kettles black. Fingers point back at us when we point. So I don't feel like nowadays I'm wonderfully deeply aware of my own virtues and strengths. Nope. But I've gotten used to doing stuff without endless stomach-churning doubt beforehand and afterward. I've gotten used to reaping the benefits of forward momentum, and I'm tired of the emptiness of crippling self-doubt. Forward momentum is powerful. There are any number of things that I've done before, so I can just say, I'll do that again. Can I sing for a street full of people at a festival? I did that a bunch of times, so now I can just say, I guess I'll go do that again about it. Can I do it? I've done it. It's not a theoretical discussion anymore. Can I write an entire book? I've done it more than once. This gives me something one could almost call confidence, though these acts are seldom undertaken, without a crippling rush of unhelpful, potentially bladder-loosening adrenaline. Whatever panic, shame, doubt, or self-loathing I may bring to acts of this kind, I have built up decades of practice just doing it anyway, continuing through the crap without it disrupting anything much. And when I really start doing well, it's not so much that I can feel the well, so much as I lose all track of myself and being someone who can panic, doubt, or any of that. I forget where I am, who I am, or what I'm doing entirely. I can stand under a spotlight in a dark room with hundreds of people and get lost in a song I'm singing sometimes. Can forget where I am entirely. And swimming in that moment when self-awareness gets ripped away by that powerful tide feels like maybe I got ripped away from it all rather than it being ripped from me. There is no self-consciousness, no awareness of lacks. The occasional slightly missed chord gets missed by everyone listening. There is a torrent, a flow that everyone gets caught up in. All is accepted. Warmth leaks everywhere, and it feels like paradise. So the lesson is that, ironically, if you go out and be yourself that God made enough, enjoying and using what He's given, you can get so lost in the stuff you do that you lose all focus upon who you even are. You can have a taste of unself-consciousness. It's good. It's paradise. And God is in there with you. You can feel Him, even if it's not a church song, and you're not a church. God wants you to be someone. I spoke with Ruth last week, and she told me that her experience regarding identity was very unlike mine. As for me, I always felt like I'd been born with a very clear, indelible identity, whether I liked it or not, and people around me did nothing but try to reject, sideline, or pharmaceutically alter it. Ruth felt like she grew up with no identity, no matter how quaint she made her outer self, like it hadn't had a chance to make itself known to her at all. Like, while I went to young people's meetings and felt continually called upon to justify why I was different, why I liked and didn't like the kinds of stuff I did and didn't like, Ruth went to youth group and went along with everyone, but still didn't fit in. Her inner identity was pretty much all nascent, latent, 100% potential, no actuality. She buried her stunted self in order to pretend that clearly they all had strong, well-developed identities that just happened to be more or less identical to her own, that she liked everything they did. What a coincidence. When actually, she said, she and many of them were kind of empty. Their personalities hadn't grown, not yet anyway, and the culture wasn't encouraging or safe for people developing, having, exploring, or expressing identities, despite the fact that God had planted those inside everyone. We were to sacrifice ourselves for Him in the meeting. And Ruth said in her 20s, after some random pinging around terribly vulnerable to this, that, and the other person or thing, way too much of a susceptible blank slate, she had to eventually come to terms with finally being who God had made her to be, which was perhaps somewhat negotiable, but was certainly going to end up with her being someone rather than just not being herself. Someone. Not merely a negation of natural impulse. Not just an obedient suppression of everything He designed into her. And all this was certainly something that had to be looked into, run after, and explored. So she had to commit to that and do it upright. And she did. And it was very contrary to how she'd been raised. And it took work. And few brethren folks liked the changes that she manifested. It didn't help her keep meeting friends. But there was really no other option that wasn't nihilistic and inhuman. She talks about crying a lot during that time, of being a wreck. Ruth became known for crying. The odd thing is, I talk about myself and about God and about Christian stuff all the time, with lots and lots of very different people, but I'm not someone who ever cries, really. However, after something had happened too many times for me to ignore it, I eventually had to recognize a fact. Every time my former pizza delivery guy Harold spoke to me about this kind of friendly, warm, collaborative, mutual, loving interplay with God, this unity with no battle over one or the other being given all the say, it made me choke up. Literally. It was confusing and unexpected. At first I tried to ignore or dismiss it, but it kept happening. It made my eyes watery, made my voice wobbly, each time. No matter what I did, I had to pretend to be interested in all the nothing that was happening out the window when he was talking. Harold doesn't have a pulpit anymore, and he needs one badly, so when you talk to him, he'll unleash a passionate sermon upon you, his congregation of one, and you get the full brunt of it right in the feels. Each time this happened, I was trying not to feel it, but it was getting me. There was a bit of a stung, angry feeling at suddenly having something somehow get past my emotional walls and touch my heart and my hope like that. That's not supposed to happen. It was a sudden vision of a relationship with God that worked. Interplay. A two-way thing. Where he wanted something other than for me to sacrifice me and not be myself. Far easier to present and view all of my relationships as being at standstills and not working. More familiar to fuss and fret over stuff not working than to have to deal with the uncomfortable, demanding reality of something working for once with someone. Seemed too good to be true to imagine something like that, like it could be a trick, and one that could lead to my ruination as a Christian and a person. To imagine a relationship that needed me in it, me as myself, not should me, not super Christian, me, now, as is. I was confused as to why this weepy, raw response was happening, as Harold and I sat in a diner and ate French fries and pie. It was food for thought, certainly. It's good to have Harold around to run stuff past in general. Sometimes we talk about the Bible, sometimes we'll ask Jake to come over and see what we all come up with when we look in that book. People tell me that this kind of coming together is absolutely not what God intends when the Bible speaks of "forsake not the assembling of yourselves together." Not what it meant when Malachi says, "Then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name." People tell me, this is not church. I'm not so sure.